This conference will now be recorded.
All right, let's see, it's around 10:30. I see that the people are still coming into the session, but we should probably get started. Dr. Thomas, are you unmuted and on camera?
I believe so.
Okay, good. So what I've done is I have set up this GoToMeeting where those who are talking will show on the screen. And so I think it'll be, Steve, we'll be able to see you in the presentation. And when I'm speaking as I am now, my understanding is people will see us here as well. So I'd like to get started if we could. So welcome everyone. And thank you for attending our conversation with Dr. Stephen Thomas on COVID-19 is the worst behind us. This is actually the first in an ongoing series of web-based conversations we're going to be bringing to our clients. And we're really wanting to focus on the horizon in a sea of change, if you will. So bearing with me one moment, I know we have this shared screen currently that I need to remove in terms of our tagline, if you will, and the like. So let me just unshare the screen. And we should be all set there. So what we're trying to do here at EPG is by connecting the best expertise in fields that matter to our clients, with our clients, we hope to deliver the very best in applied knowledge. Given this, of course, our first conversation in this series had to be around exploring the pandemic and the social, health, and economic crisis which our country is in as a result, and the outlook for the future. COVID is the catastrophe that underlies and drives this crisis, obviously. So today, we want to discuss with and hear from an expert on the front line of battling and kind of defeating this threat. And what I'd like to do, if I could, is ensure that everyone mutes their mic so we don't have any feedback loop. And therefore, you know, we can continue through. I would also ask that if you have a question you'd like to pose for Dr. Thomas, for Steve, if you could send it with the chat function. Kathleen is here as well, and she is monitoring questions that come through on the chat so that we're able to share those and get some insights from Steve at the end of the session. We'll be compiling topics and those questions for Dr. Thomas. All right, so why don't we begin? Steve, Dr. Thomas, is Chief of Infectious Diseases and Director of the Institute for Global Health and Translational Sciences at State University of New York Upstate Medical University. As a physician scientist, he cares for patients and also conducts research to find ways to prevent or treat diseases which affect us all. He's really bringing to us a true base of leadership-sourced applied knowledge that you have. So Dr. Thomas, Steve, thank you very much for joining us at EPG and our clients.
Thanks very much. I appreciate the invitation.
There's a lot to kind of discuss and learn in the next 30, 45 minutes. But what I would ask is, could you share a little bit more with us about your background and how it kind of applies to this topic?
Sure. I went to Brown University for undergraduate. I majored in medical ethics there, and then I went to Albany Medical College to get my MD. I was on scholarship from the U.S. Army during both undergrad and graduate school. So I entered the Army at that time, and I did my internal medicine and infectious diseases training at Walter Reed down in Washington, D.C. Infectious diseases physicians in the military, they kind of go, half of them go into research and development and clinical work, and then half of them just do kind of strict clinical work. I was interested in being a physician scientist and not only taking care of patients with problems, but figuring out how to kind of prevent or treat those problems. So I went in on the research and development side. So for the next 14 years, I was part of the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. I spent 6 of those years living and working in Thailand and Southeast Asia. And my niche was viral diseases, much like SARS-CoV-2 and COVID is. And so my niche was developing drugs and vaccines to protect U.S. service members. And then the last 2 years of my career in the military, I was the equivalent of the chief operating officer of the Institute, which is kind of a similar to sort of a small or moderate sized biotech. It's about 2,100 people in labs in 4 continents and about a $300 million a year operating budget. I thought it was going to be a relaxing off ramp to retirement, but we had an Ebola outbreak, a MERS-CoV outbreak, and a Zika outbreak. And so I spent those 2 years with lots of trips to the Pentagon and the White House, participating in the whole of U.S. government response. And then I retired in 2016 and went into academia here at SUNY Upstate.
Very good. Thank you, Steve, very much. So why don't we get started? Why don't we jump in? Thank you very much for the background. Very applicable at a minimum. You know, there's a lot of information and raw data that's out there that we're all getting bombarded with about COVID-19 and the pandemic. What is it? What caused it? What causes it? How did it start? You know, all those things. Could you take a few minutes and kind of give us an objective overview of COVID-19, how it came to be, what its causes is, things like that? That would be super helpful.
Sure. So COVID-19 is the disease that is caused by infection with SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID. It's a coronavirus, and we've known about these coronaviruses for, you know, since the 50s. There are 4 coronaviruses that cause about 35% of the upper respiratory infections that people get every year in the fall and in the winter. But there can be severe coronaviruses. And so SARS-CoV-1 or SARS back in 2002, which some of you may remember, that was the first severe. And then about 10 years later, we had MERS, so Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. That was the second. And now SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19, that's the third. What the predominant evidence seems to show is that, you know, these viruses exist in bats all the time. And what can happen is bats can pass them to other animals. And then those animals, if they get too close to people, so for example, if they are being captured to be sold either for food or medicine or for pets, those viruses can then jump to people. And that's what happened with SARS-CoV-1. That's what happened with MERS. And we believe that's what happened in Wuhan, China. Back in probably October, November of 2019. And so it's a virus that causes a respiratory illness. It's easily transmissible between people. And by the time the signals were available that people knew something was going on, so predominantly a cluster of pneumonia in China, it had already made its way out of China and into the rest of the world.
Well, why does it appear to be so much more of a severe respiratory infection than, say, the flu? Or what has made it so different?
Right. Yeah. So influenza is also caused by a virus, but we think SARS-CoV-2 is more transmissible actually than the flu. So we talk about this thing, and you might have seen this on TV. You know, people talking about this reproductive number. It's an important number because what it means is, it is the average number of people that a single infected person will infect. So for example, measles, which is one of the most infectious diseases on the planet, that number is about 18. So one person on average will infect 18 other people. With influenza, it's about 1.1 to 1.3. With COVID, it's about 2 to 4. So one person on average will infect 2 to 4 other people. And then each of those four people will infect 2 to 4 other people. So transmission is one thing. The other thing is that the way this virus works, and we might get into it a little bit later, it has the ability to affect almost every organ system in the body, versus flu, which is really predominantly a respiratory infection. COVID can impact all the organ systems. And so it can act actually more severe than flu or some of the other respiratory viruses that we see.
Okay. Now you, one of the things that we've talked about is how it actually kind of attacks the person and how that kind of evidences itself. Could you take a second to kind of give us that as part of this background as we move forward?
Sure. So, you know, if you imagine what the actual virus looks like, think of a tennis ball with about 40 push pins in the tennis ball. And each of those push pins, it's a protein. We call it a spike protein. Matter of fact, when you look at these under very high powered microscopes, they look like a crown. It looks like the jewels on top of a crown, which is where corona comes from. Those spike proteins are really, really important because they act like a key. And each of our cells in our kidneys, in our lungs, our nose, our mouth, that's where the lock is. And so that spike protein looks for the lock, sees the lock, inserts itself, it gets into the cell, makes baby viruses, and then those viruses go out and infect more cells in the body. And so what you get is this very, once you get infected, you get this very quick replication, spread of the virus throughout your body. And then it starts to cause its effects, both direct effects in terms of the virus causing a direct effect on the cell and the organ, but also indirect effects. So once the infection is over, then you get this huge immune response. And it's both of those things that cause people to get very, very sick and in some cases die.
Okay. So one dynamic as we kind of talk about the background and the overview is it seems like in the news and talking to people we know, symptoms vary. And it seems like new symptoms are coming up. You know, someone says, man, my eyes hurt or this or that. Are we still learning what this virus does, or do we have a sense of that?
No, we're absolutely still learning about this. You know, it's funny when I get introduced sometimes as an expert, I kind of chuckle because I'm like, are there really any experts for something that's been on the planet for only, 13 months or so? Your observation is absolutely correct, because you remember back in the beginning, the World Health Organization and the CDC, they were saying, it's pneumonia. So if you have fever and cough and shortness of breath, that could be COVID. And then it was, well, now you got to add nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. And then now you got to add loss of taste, loss of smell. And then something which we had always suspected, but it took a while to prove, probably anywhere from 30 to 50% of people who get infected, they don't have any symptoms at all, or they have very mild symptoms, but they're still very infectious to other people. And that's how these kind of small fires can become raging fires, is because you have a bunch of people who are infected, they're infectious, but they're not sick, and they're just kind of, they're kind of walking around.
Got it. Thank you. One news item that seems to be becoming more and more in the forefront relates to variants of the strain, if that's the right way to term it, that we're seeing in England, South Africa now. It's like, oh, you got to be kidding me, yet another version of this. What's the reality on that? Because that certainly affects planning and kind of visibility around when the economies will start opening up.
Right. So coronaviruses are what we call RNA viruses. So you can have DNA viruses, you can have RNA viruses. It's just a different flavor of genetic material. RNA viruses are constantly mutating. You know, as they go through the replication cycles, and whether it's animals or it's in people, there are constantly errors that are being introduced into the genetic sequence. So basically the genetic fingerprint of a particular virus. Now, most of the times these errors don't go anywhere. And coronaviruses are interesting because they typically have a lower rate of mutation, and they have a proofreading capability, we were thinking that because of those two things, we were going to have some, a little more stability, for example, than we see with flu, right? So flu, the variation that occurs every year requires us to make a new vaccine every year. But we were thinking there was going to be some stability. But we learned very quickly. I mean, back in April and May, there was a whole new variant that basically replaced, at a global scale, replaced the previous variant. The concern with these variants, so what we're seeing in the UK and South Africa, which was actually first, and then now Japan, and now in the United States, is, you know, they're starting to see these mutations that are in a key part of that virus. Remember those push pins, that spike protein? That's where these mutations are occurring. And it's concerning to people because that spike protein is the target for antibodies that we make, right? The Eli Lilly and Regeneron antibodies that have been approved or have given a EUA, an emergency use authorization from the FDA. That's the target. These vaccines that have been given an EUA, that is the target. So the concern is if you mess with the spike protein, people could get sicker and these vaccines and antibodies might not work. Fortunately, we have not seen either of those outcomes yet, but you know, this is a story that's still unfolding.
Thank you. So let's move then to the vaccine, because we certainly want to talk about that. And again, we're kind of looking on the focus, you know, where are we heading with this? Is the worst behind us? Steve, what I didn't mention in your introduction, are you involved in investigating kind of vaccines? Is it Pfizer? Can you share with me what you're doing there?
Right. So, you know, Pfizer and BioNTech are one of the manufacturers and developers that have gotten into the COVID vaccine game. Their vaccine is a messenger RNA vaccine, very similar to Moderna, which is one of the other groups out there. And so I'm the lead, what they call the kind of coordinating or lead principal investigator for the phase 2-3 global program. So about 45,000 people, 150 sites, 8 different countries, and the companies will typically pick one of the principal investigators at those different sites to just be kind of the lead investigator to help them with regulatory submissions to the FDA and that sort of thing. So that's me.
Thank you. So with that perspective that you have, I guess the big question that comes up is, are we all set with vaccines? Are we good to go? It's now just about getting as many people as possible immunized. Where do we stand with vaccine?
You know, so about, and we saw this with Ebola and we've seen it with Zika, about 200 different groups, whether they're academic or government, Department of Defense, biotech, big pharma, about 200 people initially entered the COVID vaccine development space. We're down now to about 64. Three of them have received some kind of approval, two of them in the United States. So Moderna and Pfizer and BioNTech, their vaccines have achieved emergency use authorization. You know, there's 7.5 billion people on the planet. Nobody was immune to this virus before it showed up. And so we need multiple vaccine approvals out there to meet that global need to try and make sure that this thing doesn't continue at the pace that it has been. So where we are is in the United States, which is where I'll focus. You know, we have two vaccines right now. We've shipped about 28 million vaccines, about, you know, 14 million from each of those manufacturers. And we've used around 50, we've administered the first doses of about 50%. So about 14 million doses have been given thus far.
Is that on track? Is that, again, as we kind of focus on what this means for the future and with business and things, is that lagging? Is that on track? Are we good to go? Or there's a problem? These should have all been administered by now.
So it depends on who you talk to. I mean, and it's really important because, you know, I've always said, you know, vaccines don't save lives. It's vaccination which saves lives. And so you can make the best vaccine in the world if you cannot, you know, keep it cold and you can't ship it and you can't administer it. And if most important, if people aren't willing to take it, then it's not going to have the public health benefit that you want. So I personally, you know, I was a little bit measured in my expectations, you know, to begin with, right? So how's this going to work? You have some industries that are part of Operation Warp Speed, which is a government program. And so the government is administering the program. And then you have Pfizer, which is out there on its own, just supplying under a government contract. How's the federal government and state government going to coordinate? How's the state government then going to distribute? So I was always a little measured in my optimism about how this was going to go initially. But I do believe that it is absolutely improved. It seems like the manufacturers are going to have the doses that are available. And it seems like the federal government is going to get a lot more involved with how the states are doing business, so that more vaccines can get into more arms quickly.
Does it matter? Do you think it matters which vaccine you take, without pointing to particular ones? Are they all the same?
The two that are under emergency use authorization in the U.S. are very much the same. They're both messenger RNA vaccines. They're both been proven safe, and they're both have a very similar efficacy, 94, 95%. Yeah, so they're the same, but you can't mix and match.
So, okay.
You get one dose of one and then one dose of the other. You can't do that. That's not advised.
So when you look at the vaccine, does it, I get the two shots, let's say I get on the list, and by June, we're at that point. Or maybe I should ask you, when do you anticipate most of us have access to the vaccine in the U.S.?
In the U.S., I mean, I think it's going to probably take most of 2021 to at least offer to all populations the opportunity to be vaccinated. I mean, right now, we know that people who are getting appointments to be vaccinated now in those high priority groups, so I'm talking 65 and over, the appointments are popping up in April.
Okay.
But it's going to be largely a state by state, right? There's some variance among the states of, the efficiency of their operations and the overall success of their operations. But, you know, I have a feeling that by the end of the year, we're going to be down into offering young, healthy people the opportunity to be vaccinated.
Yeah, because certainly some of the feedback when we were building this conversation, one of the questions that came up related to, our business is one of a value proposition where we are in front of people, we're among people, internal, market facing, and that's in person. And so one question is, my staff that are out there, what is going to be their comfort level with actually getting the vaccine? There's a lot of, we'll talk about that in a moment. There's some concerns. And also, once you get the vaccine, does that protect us from those potential future strains, those strains that morph?
Right. Two huge questions. So I'll unpack them.
Okay.
The first one, what I would say is that in terms of, being in a publicly facing industry, or being in a situation where you have to, interface with people, there are two ways, there are two kind of big buckets of how you can protect yourself. One is a COVID vaccine. The other is the public health interventions that we've been talking about since January and February. So, the data is extremely clear that, washing your hands, wearing a mask, and not coming to school or work if you're sick, and not gathering unnecessarily, it works. And we know that it works because in K-12 schools, for example, where they don't let kids come to school if they're sick, they control the density of kids, they control the movement of kids, they make everyone wear masks, and they don't gather unnecessarily. We know internationally, K-12 schools are not a source for transmission. When you look at groups like the YMCA, right, where they've had, they've been allowed to reopen. Let's just take New York, for example. There is extremely low a number of infections that have occurred, despite hundreds of thousands of people visiting and opportunities, for infection. We know I consult for industries and give them guidance on how to keep their factories safe, for example. When they do those types of things, the rate of infection among employees that occurs at the place of employment, extremely low. Same thing with the hospital. We have employees getting infected. We have about 11,000 employees, but they're getting infected at home. They're not getting infected at work. So that's kind of the first bucket. And then the second bucket is, of course, vaccination. So then the second piece of it, the variants, again, this is something that scientists, anytime you make any kind of vaccine or therapeutic against a virus, you are going to be concerned about mutation. You're going to be concerned about the continued benefit of that countermeasure. And so scientists were waiting to see these variants. And now that they've popped up, there are experiments that you can do to try to understand the risk. You know, fortunately, right now, there is no evidence that these vaccines are going to lose a significant amount of effectiveness. And that's good. But they, you know, it's a tough thing to try and demonstrate. You just have to continue to follow people who've been vaccinated. If they get infected, determine what strain they've been infected, and then look for trends, you know, which is why our trials are 2 years in length. You know, we're going to be following these people for 2 years.
So that actually brings up a point I wanted to raise, which was again, a question that was posed, which is the skepticism that is out there. You know, again, how it was posed to me was, look, I've got employees, I've got branches, I've got an operations center, a main office. And so what will occur if people don't believe in the vaccine? You know, I think one of the concerns is there going to be this resistance to getting the vaccine? And here's why, because the questions are, it seems like it was very fast. They're saying people are skeptical about the vaccine and its safety and potential side effects. It came out very fast. There were limited trials. It's two shots versus one currently. And it seems like it didn't have to go through typical vetting. Will I have to deal with the concern that people aren't taking the vaccine because they're concerned?
Well, so we all should be concerned if our neighbor is not interested in taking the vaccine, because the only way that we're going to be able, you know, everyone's asking about, you know, when are we going to be able to go back to normal, you know, and I think that people need to embrace the perspective that we're going to go back to a normal, but it's not going to be 2019 BC, right? It's not going to be 2019 before COVID normal. That's not going to happen. The world has changed, right? The world has changed. So I guess what I would say is, but not everybody can get the vaccine, which is why I mentioned and spent time talking about public health interventions, right? Because those do work in the absence of vaccine. But if you add vaccine to it, then it can work much faster. The changes can come along much quicker, and the effects can be sustained, right? So you protect yourself with a mask, you take the mask off, you're not protected anymore. You get vaccinated, then you're going to be protected for a longer period of time. We hope for years. But, you know, speaking to the time thing, and, you know, as a vaccine developer, it's interesting to have so many people who are now interested in, you know, how vaccines are developed, and before they really didn't want to hear me talk about it too much. But, you know, historically, it took about 10 years and over $1 billion to make a vaccine. You know, 100 horses would start the race, only one, if you were lucky, would finish the race. But there were lots of reasons for that. The primary reason was that these vaccine development companies, and rightfully so, wanted to mitigate the financial risk of a $1 billion investment with a 1% success rate. So they would do things very sequentially, pragmatically, before they would, you know, they would go through these milestones and these gates, and, you know, you had to have overwhelming evidence that the next step could be successful before you would make that investment. And a lot of that money, hundreds of millions of dollars of that money, would be tied up in manufacturing the product, number one, and number two, doing those large scale trials that show you whether the vaccine works or not. In this case, the US taxpayer, in terms of Operation Warp Speed, we basically helped to underwrite $10 billion of investment that took that risk off the table for the companies. In the case of Pfizer, they underwrote the risk themselves, a couple of billion dollars, both R&D as well as distribution plan. So that whole thing was taken off the table, which allowed them to do a lot of steps in parallel that normally occur sequentially and take a great deal of time. Good. The second thing that saved time was that the regulators, because obviously it's a pandemic, everyone's focused on the prize, which is get a COVID vaccine out as quickly as possible. So conversations that normally would have taken some time between a sponsor, a developer, and the FDA were occurring in real time, and the guidance was crisp. And that's another thing that saved time. The third thing is, you know, sometimes when you're trying to develop a vaccine against a disease that doesn't make a lot of people sick, you have to do these trials for years to collect enough cases so that you can then go to the FDA and say, see, this thing works. In the case of COVID, unfortunately, there were so many people getting infected and so many people getting sick that the companies were able to collect the appropriate number of cases that they needed very quickly. So for those three reasons, and there are others, but for those three reasons, that's how you could compress, you know, 5 to 10 years into 1 year. And then I guess the last thing I would say, because it's important, because I need people to have the facts so they can make an informed decision about whether or not to get vaccinated. Messenger RNA technology is not new. They've been working on this since the 80s. So it's not like somebody woke up in January and said, oh, wow, you know what would solve this COVID problem? A messenger RNA based vaccine candidate. Right. Yeah, they've been working on this for 30 years. And for the last 10 years, they've been doing vaccine trials in humans for different diseases like flu and Ebola and HIV and Zika. So, you know, they already had a 30-year head start on the technology.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. So one question, of course, or a key theme that we don't want to miss out on is, with all of that, how would I, owning a business, you know, well, first off, what could go wrong? At this point, and I'm looking at my business, I'm looking at my industry, you're looking at community-based financial institutions, we've talked about the footprint, you and I chatted prior. What could go wrong in this? It's a big question.
Yeah, well, I mean, what could go wrong is it could continue to go as it's going. So people, people not being willing to wear masks, not being willing to stop gathering, just those two things, that if people continue to choose to do or not do those things, then we will continue to have this problem.
Even though we have the vaccine?
Well, because again, we have about 50% of Americans who said that they're not interested in getting the vaccine. So we're not going to have any, you know, this concept that's been talked about a bunch, this herd immunity concept. What that means is, if enough people in a particular area get vaccinated, the people who cannot be vaccinated, there will still be a level of protection for them, because basically the virus does not have enough room to breathe. It doesn't have enough people that it can infect to keep, you know, a transmission occurring. But if you only have, you know, 40 or 50% of Americans saying they're willing to get vaccinated, and then you have a significant percentage of Americans who are not interested in decreasing their social circles and not interested in wearing a mask, then the worst thing is that this is going to continue. And that's something, you know, employers have to, you know, they have to worry about, because you can create the best and safest work environment you want. It's what your employees are doing outside of work, which is going to, create risk for the business.
Okay. So we know now, for example, with the with President Biden, politics aside, I think one of the executive orders was issuing that mask mandate. I think I should know more about it. That's obviously what's behind that, correct? To try to get us ahead of that until enough people do get the vaccine?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And when you look at states that have put that mandate in place, or when you look at, again, businesses or large organizations that have put that mandate in place, it's impactful. You know, there's no question that it works. When you look at other countries who have done that, who have followed that course of action, it absolutely works. So again, public health interventions plus vaccination of a high percentage of the population could turn this thing around very quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so herd immunity is not really on the table as on the list of options or remedies in,
vaccine induced. So there's two ways to get herd immunity. One, let the virus run rampant. right? That's one way. Yeah. And that's been proposed by certain people whom I think are misinformed. And I think that that's absolutely the wrong answer. But then there's also vaccine induced herd immunity. We should strive for that goal. We would be, you know, and we have achieved that goal in the past with things like measles, mumps, rubella, for example, polio, smallpox. I mean, we've achieved herd immunity at a global scale. We should be able to do it at a national scale, but it's going to take, you know, 80%+ of the U.S. population to be willing to receive the vaccine and to roll up their sleeve and to take it. What I do think we will see, you know, so we're in a pandemic, which by definition, it's a global issue, right? It's multiple regions right. being impacted. We're in an epidemic in the United States, but infectious diseases are very much a local thing. So it is possible that you will have enclaves within the United States that where vaccination uptake is high enough that you in fact will have a herd immunity type effect in some of these enclaves.
That's very important what you just said, because I noticed, Kathy, we just saw that we got a question in related chat that I'll bring up now instead of the end, which was, why shut all the economies, all populations down? Why not target where the, you know, is an entire state really a red zone or however they term it versus certain cities, certain areas? Why aren't we just trying to target those areas? I don't know if that's something you can talk to or if it's more of a government or a philosophy.
Well, it's, I mean, I think it is a, I mean, I have not had a politician or a Department of Health senior official tell me this, but my observation is that it is the practicalities of executing public health policy, which is what drives these kind of broad brushstrokes. You know, in New York, which is where I am, we have had a regional approach to things, right? Our government has, you know, our state government has different colors and based on the amount of virus that's being transmitted in a particular area. And those different colors either allow you to open or close different types of businesses or participate in other types of you know, activities. So I do think that you can take a more a surgical approach. But it's going to depend on the state. It's going to depend on the contiguous states. It's going to depend upon, you know, what type of industry you're talking about. I mean, I have, and I've been talking about this from the beginning because we saw this with Ebola and we saw it with SARS-CoV-1 and we saw it with Zika. You know, I get as concerned about the secondary and tertiary effects of outbreaks as I do about the direct effect of the disease on a particular individual or on a community. So I worry about the economy, I worry about education, I worry about travel and commerce and these sorts of things. And to me, you know, some people I think have promulgated that it's either public health interventions or open the economy. And to me, it's always been no. Public health interventions are the pathway to opening the economy because both are important, but one leads to the other. So, but I think sometimes people get confused that they think they're mutually exclusive when to me it's one lead to the other.
Got it. Okay, big question then as we have a few minutes left here. If what would you advise, you know, leadership teams who are running organizations, what are the triggers or benchmarks or I don't know, flags that I can watch for that I read in the news that will tell me there's a light at the end of the tunnel, you know? Is there anything you can share with us that says, hey, if we reach X number of vaccines applied, that will mean, you know, that kind of thing? It might not be a fair question, but.
No, it's a good question. So I can tell you what the politicians look at. I can tell you what, you know, the public health folks. Yeah, I mean, we look at the county level and then, you know, at the state level, we look at the number of new infections per day in a county. We look at the 3, 5, and 7 day averages of the number of infections. We look at the percent of positive tests that occur in a particular day. So how many people were tested? How many were positive? What's that percentage? We look at the capacity of the hospitals. So how many beds do you have available? How many staff do you have available to take care of those patients? We look at mortality a little bit, but really it's more what's the number of infections going on and what is the capacity of the hospital?
Sorry, Steve. Are there numbers that they have that one can find? You know, in other words, are there numbers that we can find saying, hey, if we hit this number, it's likely they're going to relax restrictions?
Yeah, so every county should have the county Department of Health website, and they should be putting their infection numbers on that website and updating it every day. If the county doesn't have the resources to do that, you can look at the state website. And you should also be able to look at your state government's policies on what their triggers are and when they're going to open and when they're not, and what's a good, a good trend and what's a bad trend. And so you should be able to anticipate what's going to happen. You made a point, and I think it's a good one. I also think they are going to eventually start looking at the number of vaccine doses being given, as a function of the percent of the population that's sort of getting vaccinated. I think that's also going to be part of the calculus.
Okay, thank you, Steve. So question is, if I have an employee who gets vaccinated, can they come back right away, and are they protected from getting it in my space, and are we protected from getting it from them as well?
Again, vaccine aside, I've named a number of industries where people have been working in person every single day, and they've been doing it in a safe way because they wear masks, they don't come to work if they're sick, and they get tested if they are sick, and they wash their hands, and they try to limit gatherings. So you could have employees coming to work now and have an open business now if your state allows it, by strictly applying those public health interventions.
I think, Steve, I'm looking more at, I have other employees who are very nervous, yep. And so if people are getting the vaccine, as we see that roll out, are there certain assumptions that can be made that, okay, Steve got the vaccine, he won't be able to give it to us, and he won't get it from us?
Yeah, right now, so vaccines can do a couple of things. Very, very high bar would be a vaccine prevents somebody from getting infected. The second high bar is a vaccine prevents somebody from, even if they do get infected, from transmitting it to somebody else. And then the third bar, which is the only bar that we have conclusively achieved, is if somebody gets infected, can we prevent them from getting sick? And so what we've shown with these vaccines is if you get vaccinated, your risk of getting sick is reduced by 95%. Now, they are doing experiments to look at, will this prevent transmission, one person being able to give it to another? But we don't know the answer to that. My guess is that there is some level of efficacy in terms of, just because of how these vaccines work, there will be some level of efficacy for a person's, reducing their ability to transmit to somebody else. But we don't have that proof, which is why right now we're basically saying, even if you get vaccinated, you need to wear a mask when you're not physically distant from other people.
Okay, thank you. So another question, again, if we could take 5 more minutes, Steve, do you have 5 more minutes to take? Awesome.
Yep, whatever you need.
One other question that came in, one other chat that I was just looking at, it is Norway. I guess there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that talked about how Norway is advising terminally ill people to not get the vaccine. I might be misquoting the content of the article, but it was basically that there's risk to this vaccine. We talked about that earlier, people's general fears of things. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I've seen reports that there were 29 deaths reported in people who had received the vaccine, that these folks were in a elderly population and had other medical problems, but there really are no details. The regulatory agencies are investigating, Yeah, I mean, what I would say is, again, we have vaccinated 14 million people in the United States, and to my knowledge, to my knowledge, the safety signal that Norway is concerned about has not been seen in the United States, despite having vaccinated, you know, having given many, many, many more doses than Norway. So it needs to be investigated, but I have not seen any of that safety signal in the United States.
Thank you.
At all.
Thank you. Another question that comes up is, do you anticipate, could there be a scenario where the government mandates that you must be vaccinated? I mean, has there been history, like with smallpox, has there been an example where you don't have a choice? You have to get the vaccine. The public health is too important.
Yeah, I don't see that happening at a national level. I don't even think that's on the table right now. That being said, though, private industry has come on board. So, for example, certain airlines are saying you're not getting on our plane without proof of vaccination. Like the cruise industry, right? You may not be able to go see Mickey and Goofy if you don't have proof of vaccination. So I think private entities who are not willing to take the risk of allowing an unvaccinated person, into their space, that might happen. And like with kids going to school, schools could mandate, just like they do now, that your child must be vaccinated or have a legitimate waiver for them to attend in person learning. And so I don't think it's going to be at a national federal government mandated level, but state by state and industry by industry, I do imagine that some people are going to start mandating vaccination.
So another question that we have here is, you mentioned earlier that you consult to industries, factories, things like that. Do you have a sense of what, as they're doing their business plan in those different industries, looking out over 2-3 years, are they forecasting degrees of normalcy returning? Is anyone creating models or expectation as to when they start seeing reduction in DEFCON levels, if you will? I don't know how else to put it.
Right. No, I think what they've been looking at is what changes have we made to our operations in response to the pandemic, and which of those reduced our bottom line or increased productivity, changed our margins, and are we willing to keep those changes because it turned out that they were better for business? For example, I mean, I talk to people in investment banking and whatnot who, their job was on the road selling, and they have not been on the road for about a year, yet productivity and performance, they beat their numbers in 2019. And so now they're rethinking, well, geez, maybe we need to think a little more strategically about our sales process and what needs to be done in person versus what can be remote. Good. So those are the types of conversations, that I'm
so
hearing.
It's a catalyst. This crisis is a catalyst for broader conversations around business models and the like.
Yeah. Okay. Efficiency. Great. Do I really need to, I lose 2 hours of productivity from my from these people through commuting.
Yeah, right.
I have to pay for an office and I have to get this and that, depending upon how 2020 went and depending upon what my industry is, should I adopt these types of modifications permanently?
Gotcha. So one last question related to, as I'm just looking at this here, related to the vaccine, because it sounds like so much really does rely on that herd immunity per vaccine application, right? In one sense, if for lack of a better, maybe I shouldn't call it herd immunity. Just go ahead.
I mean, it would be herd immunity is a good goal and we should go after that goal. But I think the 25 meter target is get out of this pandemic.
Right. Pandemics measured by or defined by what? What is your?
By number of new infections that are occurring in a given area every day, what the hospital capacity is like, that sort of thing.
Okay. And here's a question related to New England. And the question relates to how bad it's gotten, right? Mm. That we've seen the numbers in Massachusetts, Connecticut, New England have really gone up dramatically. And, there's a lot of talk why that is, because we had Thanksgiving, we had Christmas. Is it that simple? Is that what's happening right now?
It's gathering and not wearing masks.
That's every simple.
we had the same exact thing here. I can tell you back in April and May, we had about 150 new cases a day at its peak in our county. Our county is Onondaga County. We have about 500,000 people. So, you know, we had about 40 patients in the hospital. Maybe 10 of them were in the intensive care unit. At our peak, which we just had, so this was, you know, the first insult was Labor Day. The second insult, right, was Halloween. And then we had Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's. You know, we're getting 500 new cases a day. And our hospital, and we have three hospitals right here in Syracuse, four, you know, we had like 200 patients, 50 of them in the intensive care units. We had to stop all elective procedures, right? This is the secondary effect, right? So people with real medical problems who needed to get surgery couldn't get surgery. And then the financial, you know, we were losing $1 million a day.
Yeah.
Because of those elective procedures. So, yeah.
Why are there fewer deaths, or am I wrong? Cases have spiked, but is the death rate lower? The mortality rate? I don't know if that's the right term.
Yeah, no. Yeah, so the case fatality rate, you know, globally case fatality rate's about maybe 2.5%. In the United States, it's about 1.5%. I think it's for a couple of reasons. One, when you have so older people and people with medical problems are more likely to get in the hospital and die than younger people. So when you start changing the demographics of who are getting infected, you could have higher number of infections, but a lower death rate. So that's one thing. The other thing is we've learned how to take care of people better, right? Okay. So that's, you know, that's the second thing. And then the third thing, which I don't know if this is a national phenomenon, but it's certainly locally here, you know, that 1A group included, the 1A group for vaccination included people living in skilled nursing facilities, you know, older people living in nursing homes, et cetera. And those people were at, a greatest, you know, they provided a lot of our patients, and they unfortunately resulted in a lot of deaths. And so that patient, they've all gotten around here, a high percentage of them have been vaccinated. And so we've seen a real trickle in the number of nursing home patients that are coming into the hospital for COVID.
Okay.
Because of that. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, Steve. Well, it's certainly, you gave us some extra time, which I really appreciate, but I tried to cover a few of those topics that some of the chats came in on, but we do have to kind of wrap up the conversation. And I want to really, I know I'm speaking for all of us, but I want to thank you so much, Steve, for giving us your time and expertise. It's been super helpful and really helping, and not just understanding where we are, but I think kind of keeping eye on that future and giving us some perspective on kind of what to look for, at least what to trigger us in terms of when we hear all of this data and all of this news. So, and I also want to thank everybody who joined us this morning, and want to let you know we did record this conversation. We do have a number of attendees who I think did kind of they brought it into their system and then they distributed it. So if anyone wasn't directly on, or if they would like to have this conversation, it is recorded and we're going to post it to our portal for future reference. So Dr. Thomas, thank you very, very much, and stay well, everyone, and have a great day. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. See you, Dave.
Thank you.